Welcome to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. We study change in order to make change, linking knowledge of the past to the quest for a better future. Every other week, we examine the most pressing issues of the day through a historical lens, helping us understand what happened then and what that means for us now.
Hello, this is David Myers. I'm pleased to welcome back to Then and Now for the second conversation in a two-part series, Zev Yaroslavsky. Zev, as he's known to just about everybody, served for 40 years as a city councilor and county supervisor in Los Angeles. He gained renown and some notoriety for his chutzpah. He first ran for city council and was elected at age 26, for his blunt-spokenness and for his unparalleled mastery of policy issues. Over the course of his career, Zev got to know just about everyone in Los Angeles and engaged just about every major issue that LA faced, from land use to race relations to cultural affairs to homelessness. Several weeks ago, he published a book called Zev's Los Angeles, From Boyle Heights to the Halls of Power, a political memoir. We continue our conversation with Zev about the book and the remarkable career that stands at the center of it. One of the most fraught issues, Zev, over the course of your tenure has been race relations in both the city and the county. You were witness to some of the most tumultuous moments in the history of our region. And I'm curious how you narrate that history through your own eyes as an observer, as a public official. What stands out to you as the most significant developments over the last half century of race relations in the city and county?
Well, I think race is a constant issue in Los Angeles and in the country. I mean, you know, to paraphrase Philip Roth, Los Angeles, like everybody else, except more so, we have a history of racial discrimination, both official government sponsored discrimination and people's individual bigotries and biases, and some of it malicious, some of it just cultural bias. And you can't talk about the history of this city, especially in the time that I served, without talking about race, and not just race, but particularly as it affected the African-American community. You know, whether you talk about the chokehold controversies of the early 1980s when we banned the chokehold finally in 1982, or whether it was the beating of Rodney King, which was not news to most African-American young people. But it was sure news to most everybody else because it was on videotape. And the only difference between that and all the other ones is it was on videotape. It was caught on videotape. And I think it was a wake-up call. I mean, even George H.W. Bush found it outrageous. Even Daryl Gates said it was out of policy until he decided to back off and defend his department. So the racial inequities, which I think we understand, at least I'll speak for myself, I understand a lot more profoundly since I was in the County Board of Supervisors, because we dealt with the social ills of our community. We are the principal provider of human services and all these. You couldn't escape the fact that communities of color, poor communities, whatever color they were, black communities, what Lyndon Johnson called the crippling legacy of racism, bigotry, that was all, that was very much a part of Los Angeles. I mean, at the county, the disparities in healthcare delivery, which we even are growing to understand more profoundly since the pandemic because of the way that played out and continues to play out in the black community and in poor communities. I personally, when I was considering running for mayor in 1987-88, for the 1989 election, when I first launched my exploratory committee, I did not expect, and I was certainly hopeful, that Tom Bradley wouldn't run again. But he decided to run again, and all of a sudden I found myself, a white Jewish guy from the West Side, running against a legendary icon, African-American icon, and generally an icon. I do believe he was the most consequential mayor in our lifetime. And it became racial, and the campaign didn't even start, and it became racial. So I experienced it both coming and going.
Well, let me ask you, Zev, what were, when you were a public official, what did you sense to be both the potential and the limits of government to address, confront, uproot deep structures of racial inequality?
Look, I think that to answer the question directly, I think there was some potential. We changed some policies that, you know, it certainly hasn't solved the problem. I mean, in terms of community relations with the LAPD, there's been a lot of effort made. It's hard to change the culture of an institution that is 100 or more years old, whether it's a corporation or whether it's a police department. And Bill Bratton, who came in here attempting to radically change the culture, even, you know, he was there for 7 years. As the old saying goes, the chief comes and goes, the department lives forever, and the culture lives, it dies hard. So, but the potential is there, and we made incremental changes.
What do you think some of your impact was, given your attention to this issue?
Well, but I don't know how to weigh my impact, David. It was, you know, we moved to make the department more diverse, to make the department look more like the city it serves, to get people to sign up for the police department, be recruited into the department who came from the communities that were most impacted by some of the problems that we're talking about, the distrust that the communities have with the police department, and in some cases for good reason. So that was the potential. The frustrations is that it never moves fast enough. As the pragmatist in me says, you know, you don't turn this battleship around on a dime. The idealist in me says you got to try, because we don't have all that much time. And we see what happens when the pressure cooker builds and people's frustrations increase, and it manifests in some pretty destructive ways, whether it was the 1992 uprising, which wasn't just in South LA, it was across town, or whether it's in the kinds of racial conversation that was revealed in these recordings of the city officials last year, or as it manifests in the things you see, you know, that are hiding in plain sight, people who, blacks who are dying, vaccinated blacks were dying at a faster rate than vaccinated whites. Unvaccinated blacks were certainly dying at a faster rate than unvaccinated whites. They have, you know, those of us who have jobs and provided health insurance and get vaccinated and have access to drugstores who provide you with a vaccination, that's not the case in some communities where you can go for miles and not see a CVS drugstore.
And there's also young black men who continue to be killed by law enforcement across the country, including in our region.
There's no question about it, and it continues to be a problem. So I write in the book that you know, when Rodney King happened, I thought to myself, all this effort that all of us had put in, not just me, but Tom Bradley, the other members of the city council, trying to diversify the police department and do all the right things, was it all for naught when it comes down to this? And I will tell you that I think that the entire city leadership, political leadership, was caught unaware, and was caught with its pants down, not appreciating how much frustration had been building in the black community in particular, but also in other economically and otherwise disadvantaged communities. You know, I believe that to this day, I would bet my firstborn that the jury in Simi Valley would not have come in with acquittals for all of those officers. I think that was part of what blew the lid off the city at the time. But if things had progressed in any significant way, even that would not have caused the eruption that caused. There was something else going on, and I don't think we have our arms around it. You asked me once whether I thought the arc of history is bending towards justice, and I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think it's, you know, again, the idealist in me says yes. The pragmatist in me says, you got a 6-3 Supreme Court that doesn't believe in justice, from my point of view, at least not the brand of justice that has been part of jurisprudence for the last century or three quarters of a century. So, and there's frustration in you know, any political leader has to understand that you got to be respond, even in dictatorships. they can't just, I remember the mayor of Moscow visiting here in the early 90s, and he'd been the mayor for a long time. And he was asked about, you know, what keeps him up at night. And he says, well, I worry about the wheat shipments not coming in from Ukraine to Moscow, because the city owns all the bakeries. And if there's no bread in the bakeries, people are going to be pissed off, and they're going to be pissed off at me. And I thought for a second, what does he care if they were pissed off at him? In the communist days, he was it. But even then, he was worried about getting people upset. So we need to do a better job of, and I think, you know, diversifying the political leadership, diversifying the employment force, diversifying the police force, the fire department, to get more women in the police department and the fire department. This is something that I fought hard for. There are all kinds of things we could be doing better than we've been doing it. And does that solve the problem? Hey, listen, we've been around for 400 years in the North American continent, and obviously our ancestors have left something in the cupboard for us to work with.
All right. Well, on that note, let's turn to another seemingly persistent and perhaps intractable problem, which is homelessness. You've seen over the course of your lifetime, really, an explosion of the unhoused population in the city of Los Angeles. And I'm wondering when you perceived that it was going to become the problem it is, whether you think it's soluble, and can it be without a massive shift in priorities or really redistribution of wealth in this country and our region?
Well, look, when did I first deal with it? I'll tell you exactly when I dealt with it. Of course, we were all aware of it, but it was not the priority issue that it became for me after I had a conversation with my daughter in the early 2000s. She was at the Kennedy School at Harvard getting her master's in public policy. She was doing an internship in the summer between her 2 years in Oakland. She called me one night. She said, I was sitting on Telegraph Avenue, walking on Telegraph Avenue, and I saw a homeless person sitting there, and I sat next to him and engaged him in conversation. And if you know my daughter, this is the kind of thing she would do, very humanist approach to life. And I talked to him for 20 minutes, and then I got up. Before I got up, I opened my purse to give him a couple of bucks, and he said, I don't want your money. You've given me something far more important. You've given me your time and respect. And I said, that's very touching. And then she said, and Dad, while we were sitting there, hundreds of people walked by us, and not one of them made eye contact with either one of us. And that got to me, because she could have been talking about me. You know, when I got off the Melrose Avenue off-ramp of the Hollywood Freeway, which was my off-ramp going home if I used the freeway, I never made eye contact with the homeless guy who had the franchise of that off-ramp. Because if I did, I'd have to do something. And, you know, life's too busy, and, you know, I've got other things to do. Everybody did that. And it became a metaphor for me. The story she told me became a metaphor for what the whole society, our whole society has done. We haven't made eye contact with this problem. And until you make eye contact with the problem, you're not going to solve it. Even if it's seemingly insoluble, it's certainly going to be insoluble. You know, Wayne Gretzky didn't make 100% of the shots he didn't take. If we don't take the shot on this, then we can guarantee that it won't be solved. We have no right to say it's insoluble. I can't personally believe that it's insoluble, because if it's insoluble, then we're consigning ourselves to this dystopian society that we seemingly have from time to time. Now, you know from the paper we did on the history of homelessness in Los Angeles that while it feels like there's an explosion of homelessness, as a percentage of our population, it isn't radically different than it was in the past. What is different is who the homeless are, what's causing it, the economic divide, the income and inequality, the incredibly punishing cost of housing, especially for people in the lower end of the economic income spectrum. That's number one. Number two, and this is an optics issue, in the old days, homeless people didn't live in tents. They slept in sleeping bags or with a blanket, and you didn't see them. Now every homeless person seemingly has a tent, and so it looks a lot more impactful. But in a way, that's a good thing, in that it creates a billboard for us. You know, the visibility makes it's in our face, and we can't just ignore it. So making eye contact is critical. So after that conversation with my daughter, within a year, I hired a woman by the name of Flora Gil Krisiloff, who had lost a race for the city council in the far west side to Bill Rosendahl. I knew her through her community activity. She was a registered nurse professionally. She had she's a social worker. And I said, why don't you come onto my staff and work with me on mental health issues? And she did. And quickly evolved to being my homeless deputy. And for all intents and purposes, was the homeless czar in the county because nobody else was touching it with a 10-foot pole. And I'm not critical of them because I was the same way until my daughter woke me up. But once I got the flame in me, this became a passion. And so we started, you know, I have a whole chapter about homelessness. We did a pilot program in Skid Row. Can we house the most likely homeless people to die on the streets if we don't give them help and housing and services? And this is an idea that came to me from a woman in New York who ran an organization called Common Ground, which traffics in the whole homeless space. And she's very, very good and nationally recognized. And when I was in New York for my son's law school graduation, I went to visit her. I thought it would be an hour and, you know, be done with it. I spent a whole almost two-thirds of a day with her, and she educated me a lot about this. And she said, what you should do is do a pilot program. This is where I got the idea. She says, and I'll bring people from all over the country to the County Hall of Administration, and we'll have a brainstorming session. And that's what we did. Out of that came a pilot program called Project 50. We picked the 50 most vulnerable people on the streets of Skid Row, and we were determined to house them because the lore was they don't want housing, which is bullshit. Excuse my French. It's just not true. Now, it's true that some of them will not go into housing right away because they don't trust anybody. Some of the homeless that we found on Skid Row had been on the streets for 30 or more years. Imagine that, 30 years on the streets of Los Angeles. And so we were able to demonstrate not only are they willing to come into a program, but they're willing to get services. You have to ease them into it. And what we found out most significantly, Miguel Santana worked for the county at that time, and he did a study, a cost-benefit analysis, said that housing homeless people and giving them services that rendered them homeless in the first place is cheaper than leaving them on the streets. Because when you leave them on the streets, they run up a cost. They go to the emergency room because they get sick or they get hurt. They land in our jails. That costs money. It's one thing after another. And not that the cost-benefit analysis should dictate anybody's moral decision, but my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors had a diverse opinion about this thing, about this issue. And, you know, for my more conservative colleagues, if I couldn't convince them on the humanity of it, maybe I could convince them on the economics of it. And I couldn't do it. The program was a success. 91% of the people who were on the program stayed in the program. One of them died, and one of them went back to where he came from outside of California. And so the logical thing to do, and was recommended by Miguel at the time, is to scale the program. And we wanted to take it to 500. And then when we perfected that, we'd go to 5,000. This is in 2010 or 11. And I couldn't get a second vote. I couldn't even get a second to a motion to scale it up, the recommendation of the CEO. So one of the great disappointments of my public service career is that we weren't able to do it. And even more disappointing now that we see what's going on, because we lost a decade, almost a decade and a half. And now, because of COVID and because of it's become a political issue. It was never a political issue before. No councilman, no supervisor felt a threat to his or her political longevity because of homelessness, because it was confined to downtown and a small part of downtown. Now it's everywhere. It's in Pacific Palisades. It's around Beverly Hills. Beverly Hills kicks them out, but they end up landing in the city of LA. and we can't kick them out.
Which in some sense brings us back to the structural problem that you talked about earlier, which is city, county, and sort of these overlapping and often countervailing lines of authority. I mean, what would it look like if you had all 88 cities in the county of Los Angeles working in sync to address this problem, you know, where you don't move the unhoused from one jurisdiction to another, dump them across the border and say it's your problem, but a more holistic utopia.
So I'll give you the answer that that people who want to run for president but don't want to say it always give the interlocutor who asks it. That's a hypothetical question, and I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. You're never going to get all 88 cities to agree. Each city has its own identity. Each city has its own demographic. I mean, I think Beverly Hills is a classic example. They're not under the same court settlement that the city of LA is on. People always wonder, why are the homeless on the city of LA side of the street and not on the Beverly Hills side? Because Beverly Hills can kick them out. And that would be a bad thing. It's a bad thing to kick them out. But they don't do anything to address the issue. But the city of LA can't move them. And, you know, they can move them from one sidewalk to another, but that doesn't solve the problem. So, yes, it is a part of the governance problem. But again, we're not going to change the governance structure anytime soon. So I am really thrilled with the way Karen Bass has taken this issue on since she became mayor. She declared a state of emergency on her first day in office, which on the margins will give her more authority to do things, but that's not the importance of the declaration. The importance of it was she declared to the people, not just of the city of LA, but of this region, I'm in charge. I'm taking responsibility. Hold me accountable for the results. And I'm not running for anything else. This is my last stop in politics. And she did something that no other mayor has done, which is to own the issue. And I can't tell you how important that is. If the people will give her the space to do what needs to be done. This is not a problem that grew up overnight, and it's not going to be solved overnight. And if there's one thing I would say to any political leader, don't promise more than you can deliver. Under promise and over deliver, not the other way around, because people have become cynical for good reason. You know, that both Karen and Rick Caruso said we're going to house 30,000 people the first year we're in office. That's impossible, literally impossible. But you have to say it because you're running for office, and you can't be out, you know, homeless by your opponents. So they all made promises that they could not keep. But Karen has, in her first, you know, 5 months now, has taken ownership of the issue, and she's making progress on it. I can tell you because I watch it closely. This is an issue that still bothers me and interests me. You know, she hasn't housed 30,000 people. She's housed something between 1,500 and 2,000 people. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people to get off the street. And once the infrastructure, the social service infrastructure scales, and they have mental health workers to deal with them and other professionals to deal with the problems, because if you don't deal with the problems and landed them on the street in the first place, you won't solve the problem. I think she's on the right track. Now, the other question you asked, which is the more, you know, compelling question, is, you know, I think until we find a way to resolve the disparities in income and economic resources, we're destined to continue to live with this problem. Because unlike 100 years ago, where it was people down on their luck, they were confined in Skid Row, there weren't a whole lot of them. Now, the main reason we see homelessness growing in society, not just in LA, is because of the economics and the cost of housing. So somebody's going to get evicted from their rent-controlled apartment so that a guy can build a new market-rate apartment building or a condominium project, which none of them can afford, which most people can't afford. And they're going to have to go out and fend for themselves in the free marketplace of apartments, and they can't afford it. They simply can't. For, as I said before, 40% of the households in LA County earn less than $60,000 a year in annual household income, and 18% earn less than $30,000 of the households, not of the individuals. You can't live in this town on $30,000 or $45,000 a year unless you're making incredible sacrifices, and you're just one layoff notice away or one eviction away from landing on the streets. In the survey we do at the Luskin School, This year, 28% of the people said that they go to bed at night worried that they're going to lose their home or their residence and become homeless as a result. 28%. Now, that they're not all going to become homeless, and the overwhelming majority will not become homeless. But if 28%, which is equivalent to 2.8 million people, are anxiety-ridden over possibly becoming homeless, that's not a good thing. And needless to say, so until we deal with the economic, and I don't have an answer to the economic disparities, wealth transfer, there are efforts all kinds of ways to try to transfer wealth and to, even some of the housing proposals that have come out of Sacramento has been somewhat in that vein. Transfer of wealth is not a local issue. It's not even a state issue. It's a national issue. And I wouldn't hold my breath, and I would tell my grandchildren not to hold their breath about any massive transfer of wealth. What you've got to do is increase incomes at the lower end of the spectrum. I was very involved as a councilman and as a supervisor in the Justice for Janitors movement, which was, one of the great experiences of my life. I mean, they thanked me for what I did for them. I said, I didn't do anything for you. You did a lot for me because it gave me some meaningful purpose in my political life that, these were the people who came to work to clean my office as I was going home to my families. And I always looked at Alma, who was the janitor on the 8th floor of the Hall of Administration. And I just wondered what her life was like. She had a family, and she was a county employee, so she had insurance, health insurance. She got vacation time and sick leave and all the goodies. The people, largely undocumented people who were working in the private sector buildings, they couldn't get a $1 an hour raise in their wages. And they came to me and asked me if I would talk to some of the building owners. Most of the building owners were my constituents. Some of them were my supporters and had contributed to my campaigns. And I went to people, I won't mention any names, they're still around, they're good people. And they said, if we give them a pay raise, increase a dollar a year, then everybody's going to be forced to do it. And I said, so what? I said, well, really, how much is it going to cost you to raise the wage of a janitor by $1 or $2? Raise the freaking rents on your tenants. They can afford to pay more. And spread it around your tenants. But the line we used to use, because it was true, is that janitors and home care workers, it's another cause that I was involved in, got paid less than the people who take care of the animals in the zoo. Now, I know all the animal people, the rights people, will say that's an insult, but it's ridiculous. I mean, the people who care for people who are dying are being paid less than people who are cleaning up the dung in the chimpanzee cage. I'm sorry. It's just I'm not a socialist.
You're sounding like one. You're sounding like one. I want to use that as a jumping off point to ask you how you do see yourself and what animates you. So what really would you say are the two or three values that have animated you in your life that you've most aspired to realize in your career?
Okay, but I'll answer that question, but first I want to finish the answer to the other question. I'm not a socialist, but I do believe that socialism has some ideas that are worthy of, and by the way, our country believes the same way historically from FDR, most of the present, that you've got to be, that you cannot have a dog-eat-dog world where everybody's out to fend for themselves. There are characteristics of government intervention to make sure that there's some floor that below which people won't fall. One of the things that animated me, again, in no particular order, the Bill of Rights animates me. I'm an avid, passionate Bill of Rights hawk, not necessarily the Second Amendment, but certainly separation of church and state, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. When I took my oath of office, I swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And it was just a line, right? We all just uttered the line. Until you get confronted with an issue of a constitutional issue, because what is the Bill of Rights if nothing else, at least the First Amendment, It's there to protect the minority against the tyranny of the majority. So defending the interests of the minority is politically unsustainable in the eyes of a politician, because you alienate enough people over time, you don't get reelected. But yet that's the oath you've sworn to uphold. And so I've told this to elected officials, who people who were asked me to swear them in. And I said, look, I'd say it in front of their audiences. I said, when you get to that line, be sure you understand what you're saying. It means that when people are being beaten by law enforcement in an unconstitutional policing policy, you got to stand up for the people who are being beaten, no matter who they are and what the circumstances were. There are certain excesses you can't abide. That's what animated me. You know the story well of the Christian cross and the county seal. I won't go into all the details, but it was a very unpopular position to support the removal of the Christian cross from the county seal, because, and I know there were polls done, the overwhelming majority of people did not see anything wrong with it. But it was unconstitutional. And even our lawyers told us, you will lose. Usually lawyers say, on the one hand, you might lose, the other hand, you might win. There was no debate, no doubt about what the result would be. And, I took on that cause, not by choice, but because we were threatened with a lawsuit. But I felt very strongly about it. I didn't take as much heat as my two colleagues, Gloria Molina, who just passed away, and Yvonne Burke, who are Christians, and they were getting pilloried by their pastors and ministers. You know, we understand the perfidious Jew being for removing the cross, but you're betraying your own religion, and I saw it, and I'll tell you a story about Gloria Molina, which I haven't really ever told. It was done in closed session. There was a point in time where I thought they were getting so pilloried that they needed an off-ramp. So I suggested in closed session, why don't we take the San Gabriel mission, put it on this. There are two views of the mission. One has a cross on the top of it, a small cross. One had none. And we were going to put the one with no cross on it. And I said, why don't we take the other profile of the mission, and then everybody will be happy. And Gloria Molina said, if the cross is unconstitutional, then there shouldn't be a cross at all, and I'm not going to support it. I said, fine. I was just trying to help. And this is why I had so much respect for her. And, you know, she was fearless. And when it came to things that she cared about. So the First Amendment is one of my passions. I ask in the book, every politician should look himself or herself in the mirror and ask, what issue am I willing to lose my job over? If you can't answer that question, then you don't belong in the business, because there comes a point, and there will come a point in every politician's life where they're going to have to make a decision. Do I do what's right, or do I do what's convenient for me? And obviously you do a lot of things that are convenient for you that are also right. But you've got to be able to say, over this, I'm willing to die on the hill.
What was that for you?
For me, it was the Constitution. For me, it was police excesses. For me, it was separation of church and state. For me, it was Muslims who were being discriminated against long before Trump. We had a case, God bless the late Hal Bernstein, but there was a Pakistani community in his Northwest Valley district, and they wanted to build a mosque, and they needed a variance because they wanted to build a minaret on the mosque. But there was a three-story, 45-foot height limit in that area of Chatsworth, and they wanted a variance so they could go beyond 45 feet, and he opposed it. I said, Hal, how can you oppose a minaret, for crying out loud? This is, and what difference does it make? It doesn't generate traffic or pollution or anything. Nobody's going to be upset about it. And he finally relented. I give him credit for that. But, you know, those are the things that animate me. And the other thing that animates me, there was a British historian, to bring it back to our history department, Lord Thomas Macaulay, a 19th century British historian, who had a line, which I came across early in my career. And I said, man, This speaks to me, and it was as follows: no man is fit to govern great societies who hesitates about disobliging the few who have access to him for the sake of the many he will never see. And that, if there's one sentence that describes what animated me day in and day out, it's that. I didn't really care about the people who were rich enough or influential enough to hire a lobbyist and hire a consultant and to throw the, you know, the book at you. I was more interested in the people who couldn't do it. And those were the majority of my constituents. And by the way, most of them didn't vote or couldn't vote. And but they were my responsibility too. And that animated me probably as much as anything. And what is it? It's about fairness. It's about responsiveness. It's about, you know, making eye contact with people and even people who make you uncomfortable. That's what animated me. And that's why I think I have a reputation for being a bit out there and taking on issues that nobody else would take. And frankly, that's the way I operated. I didn't want to compete with anybody for other issues that were more politically remunerative. I had plenty of remuneration in my day. Where I came in handy for the body politic was I was willing to take on issues that nobody else would touch. I was the first straight politician to stand up to John Briggs in Southern California in 1978 with Proposition 6, which would have banned gays and lesbians from teaching in the public school system. Nobody else did, and I don't fault them for it. But you know, I was elected in a district that was very forgiving. They actually elected kind of maverick people over the years. Roz Wyman at the age of 22, Ed Edelman, who was himself, came in at the age of 30. He was a liberal, a strong liberal. They elected me, and I took that charge as having a responsibility for them not to just keep the lid on, you know, not to let moss grow on my derriere. But they gave me the gift of being willing to push the envelope and to take on causes that other people couldn't politically do. And they had my back. So I wasn't worried about Daryl Gates or Ed Davis, because I knew that my constituents weren't going to be bamboozled by that BS that they tried to spread through their community relations officers, and they did have my back. So Macaulay is, I'd like to talk to him if I could. That's a great line. No man is fit to govern great societies who hesitates about disobliging the few who have access to him for the sake of the many he will ever see. I can tell you that I disobliged the few who had access to me over and over again. Didn't make me feel good, but it made me, it was what I had to do. On rent control in 1978, a year before, the apartment house developers saw it coming. And some of them were my main contributors in my first campaign, and I didn't have a lot of contributors. And three of them invited me to have breakfast in the basement of the Ollie Hammond Steakhouse on La Cienega Boulevard. It was like a mafia. It looked like a mafia hangout. It wasn't a mafia hangout. And they tag teamed me and they said, "We were there for you when you needed us. Now we need you to be with us against rent control." And it was a seminal moment, because it was the first test that I face of that nature. And I told them, all three of them, and they're all three dead now, so I feel comfortable telling you this, you supported me not because I was going to be your handmaiden. You supported me because I was a maverick. I was independent. I was going to stand up to special interests. I stood up to Tom Bradley by running against his candidate. That's why you supported me. You didn't expect me to win. You took a flyer on me, and I appreciate it very much. But you shouldn't be surprised that after you know, knowing who I was, that you could in any way pressure me to do something that would go against the many thousands of people at whose doors I knocked and who were complaining about the, especially elderly people who were fearful that they were going to be forced out of their apartments. They didn't know where they were going to go. So the answer is no, I'm not going to be with you. And that was 2 years into my career. And some of those three people never talk to me again, and so be it. But I'll disoblige those who have access to me for the sake of the many we never see.
And that, Sev, I will say, made for really an extraordinary career in public service. I want to remind listeners that they can read much more in much more granular detail about many of these fascinating chapters in the career of Zev Yaroslavsky and his memoir, Zev's Los Angeles. I want to ask you a final question, which is a sensitive and meaningful one to you, I think. What was the place of Barbara Yaroslavsky in your making as a politician?
Well, she was everything. And if you read the book, the dedication, which is 1,500, 2,000 words, says it all. People look at spouses of elected officials, especially female spouses of male public officials, and say, "Oh, they're good spouses, they're a good political spouse." She didn't come along for this ride. She was part of the ride, and she forged some of the trails many of the trails that I traveled. I mean, I didn't do anything without her. She was the first woman I dated when I was just out of UCLA by a couple of months. And never dated another person. And she, we were together for 51 years. And my great regret is, as much as I appreciated her and I loved her unconditionally and all that stuff, I only wish I could have appreciated more of how much she meant to so many people. And that became so powerfully apparent to me when she died. I got hundreds of letters from people out of nowhere. She served on the medical board of California, and she was a delegate to the National Association of Medical Board Members. And I get a letter a couple of months after Barbara died from a woman who was on the Minnesota medical board saying, I just found out that your wife died, and I just want you to know that she was incredibly helpful to me when I was having issues with my kids. And she gave me advice. And so this was one of hundreds of letters like that. I guess I now realize how lucky I was. I knew I was lucky to have this relationship. There's no question about that. But I didn't know how lucky I was, and that while she was with me, and in an integral, critical, crucial part of my life, she was also a crucial part of the lives of hundreds and hundreds of people. And I don't understand how she did it. And I said it at her funeral, I don't know where she got the bandwidth. She kept expanding her bandwidth. And the more she expanded it, the more she had to expand it some more. And she was, she was an integral part of my life. There was not a single decision I made that I didn't vet with her. I don't think there was a single op-ed that I didn't ask her to read before I submitted it, from the ridiculous to the sublime. And I'll tell you, she wasn't just my spouse. She was an incredibly consequential leader in this community and in the state, and she didn't get a nickel for it. And I miss her a lot. So yeah, she was part of my journey, very much so.
Well, thank you for sharing that memory, Zev, and thank you for sharing your experience both in this two-part series and in your really remarkable memoir that, as we said at the outset, is at once an insight into your personal career and really a history of Los Angeles. It's been great talking with you, and you're always welcome back on Then and Now.
And I appreciate all of your guidance along the way, David. You have been an incredible resource to me, and one of the reasons I came to UCLA after I retired, and not regretting a minute of it. Thank you so much.
And great to have you.
Thank you for listening to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. You can learn more about our work or share your thoughts with us at our website, luskincenter.history.ucla.edu. Our show is produced by David Myers and Rosalind Campbell, with original music by Daniel Reichman. Special thanks to the UCLA History Department for its support, and thanks to you for listening.